Are we ready for a woman president?
When I would ask the question, do you foresee having a woman president in your lifetime? Many people would answer, well, sure, if Hillary runs.
Plus, how private is a phone conversation? And a collection of personal essays about a city that's hard to let go. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. The speculation is well underway about the 2016 presidential race, with Hillary Clinton keeping her options open as others say she's the obvious Democratic nominee. But it was a rocky road during her last campaign, with the press and analysts criticizing her hair, her clothes, her personality, remarks we just didn't hear about male candidates. So what's it going to take to get a woman elected as the leader of the U.S.? Are we just not ready yet? Writer Marianne Schnall asked dozens of people, from politicians to political activists, and put their answers into a book called What Will It Take to Make a Woman President?
Well, this project really came unexpectedly. I'd say the very, very beginning inspiration started with a conversation with my daughter Lotus, who at the time was 8 years old. It was right after Barack Obama was elected, and we were sort of celebrating how wonderful it was to have our first African-American president, and she just looked at me and said, why haven't we ever had a woman president? Really, what wound up happening is I thought I would do 20 interviews, and everybody kept very helpfully saying, you should interview, you know, this person, and helping me with additional, you know, contacts. And the next thing I knew, I was interviewing up to, you know, 50 people for the project. So it really, you know, took a life of its own, and it feels like a very collective project for that reason.
Of course, this is a political issue, and I know you tried to be bipartisan about this or impartial, but I wondered if you did get different viewpoints on this.
There were so many different perspectives, and I think that's really what I came out of, that is that this is this conversation will benefit from having a lot of different approaches and different perspectives. There's not one single solution. There's a lot of different lenses. There's a lot of different issues that are related to some of the problems and areas that we need to address to sort of have more women in leadership. And I think I did very purposely set out for it to be bipartisan, because I think that, you know, this isn't a political issue. It's not a partisan issue. And so I really did want to make sure that that was a purposeful idea. And even in the terms of including men, this isn't also a women's issue. We all benefit from having more diversity in our leadership. And that is ultimately what democracy is supposed to be about.
Did people of a more conservative bent give you a different response to the question, what would it take to get a woman president?
You know, actually, it really wasn't that different. I think that there was a lot of, you know, common denominators in what, you know, the people that I interviewed thought, you know, would be helpful. I would say the only difference in some of the specific types of, you know, answers I was getting from some of the, and I wouldn't even call them conservatives because, you know, they were, you know, some of them were Republican, you know, strategists, whether it's Anna Navarro or, you know, Governor Mary Fallon or some of the Republican congresswomen, was more about the need to sort of rebrand the Republican Party and better appeal to, you know, women voters, and certainly to have more women in their ranks. So from that viewpoint, I think that that was what was different. But ultimately, a lot of the same themes came up in terms of what was needed, whether it was, you know, campaign finance reform or, you know, encouraging women and girls to see themselves as leaders, or the need to balance, you know, work and family, to have men take on more of those roles. That came up a lot, you know, on both sides of the aisle. So there was a lot of commonalities to some of the insights that people gave to me.
Of course, you can't have this discussion without talking about Hillary Clinton, who came very close to getting the Democratic nomination for president, and who is rumored to be thinking about it again.
First, let me say that it was definitely the point again and again. It's not just about, you know, any woman, or just, it is, you know, I think it was, you know, Jane Fonda who once said to me, you know, it's less about gender and more about consciousness. So about having the right candidate, for sure. Hillary's name came up again and again without me having to raise it. I heard from all, when I would ask the question, do you foresee having a woman president in your lifetime? Many people would answer, well, sure, if Hillary runs. So, you know, I did get that sense. But I was very struck by the fact that when I interviewed both Nancy Pelosi and Kirsten Gillibrand, that they said that that they felt that she was sort of uniquely qualified and positioned to maybe achieve that milestone. I remember they both used the term that she, because of all of her experience, she would, it would make her one of the, you know, quote, most prepared presidents in history. So there was definitely that sense that we definitely have a better shot at doing this sooner rather than later because of that. One thing that I definitely think is important also to say, and the reason why I interviewed so many men for this project, you know, like, for example, you know, Nicholas Kristof or Gavin Newsom, is because we really need to not see this anymore as a, quote, women's issue. Men are just as interested in seeing women in these positions. And, you know, as Nicholas Kristof told me, this is not something that will just benefit the women of America. It'll benefit all of America. So I feel that, you know, it's really important to highlight that. But also, the interesting conversation that was that I got both from men and women about the need to change gender roles for both men and women. Part of the reason we may not be as, you know, comfortable or familiar seeing women as leaders is because of these very, you know, constrictive gender roles that also prevent us sometimes from seeing men as caretakers and nurturers, which, you know, we certainly need more men to be able to fulfill those type of roles and responsibilities so we can have more balance, you know, for sort of both genders. So for me, that was really interesting and important that that came, you know, coming up, and also this sort of reframing of this is not a women's issue. This is something that will benefit all of humanity.
Marianne Schnall is the editor of What Will It Take to Make a Woman President? Find out more at womanpresidentbook.com. One thing a U.S. president now has to deal with is the question of security versus ethics. The revelation that the U.S. has been spying on the private cell calls of world leaders led to some pretty embarrassing high-level conversations and a consideration of banning such spying in the future. Secret recordings have been used as weapons in political campaigns, too. But does anything go, particularly in the media? Do public officials have a right to privacy? Or is the value of the information such recordings bring to light outweigh that right? It's a question considered by the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs.
Aided by cell phones doubling as digital recording devices, political activists and campaign operatives are on a bipartisan race to produce gotcha moments. Once made public, these recordings often go viral and can effectively derail opponents. For example, a liberal activist recently admitted to placing a bug in Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell's office and recording a conversation between the Republican and his campaign staff. In 2010, conservative activist James O'Keefe was caught tampering with the telephones at Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu's Louisiana office. He pleaded guilty to entering the property under false pretenses. O'Keefe had previously gained notoriety for his hidden camera sting operations against the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, better known as ACORN. Mitt Romney's infamous claim that 47% of Americans are too dependent on government was secretly recorded by a bartender at a private event in 2012 and may have permanently set back Romney's bid to unseat President Barack Obama. Each recording made headlines when it was leaked to the media. Secret recordings, though, are an ethical gray area for journalists. The Society of Professional Journalists' Code of Ethics advises reporters to avoid undercover or other surreptitious methods of gathering information, except when traditional open methods will not yield information vital to the public. Nevertheless, the traditional media has largely played along, reporting on these stories and the controversies they generate, despite the tactics employed. What do you think? Is it ethical to make secret recordings of a political opponent? If public officials think they're speaking off the record, do they have a right to privacy? Should the media run stories generated by hidden cameras and bugs? Is the public value of these recordings too important to ignore? Does the upsurge in secret recording for political purposes pose a larger threat for the democratic system? I'm Gusta Johnson for the Carnegie Council.
made possible by the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs. Post a comment at www.carnegiecouncil.org.
Coming up, an anthology of essays about loving and leaving New York. And what is it about those essay collections that we love so much? If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% Archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1270. Joan Didion's essay, Goodbye to All That, was the inspiration for a collection of essays about the joys and pain of living in New York City and why it's so hard to leave. Collected by New York City expat Sari Botten, it's a love song about a difficult romance. Nothing about loving New York is easy. Botten is the editorial director of the TMI Project, a nonprofit organization that offers memoir and writing classes to people who have stories they need to tell. She talks about the differences and the similarities of collecting stories for very different kinds of projects.
It's been very validating for me because it's a project I wanted to do for like 8 years, and agents kept saying to me, great idea, don't do it. And the biggest lesson for me in this is don't wait for people to give you permission. Or as Eleanor Roosevelt said, something like, never accept no from someone who isn't in the position to tell you yes. I did it even though I knew I probably wouldn't make a lot of money, and I had so much other work I was doing at the same time. And so it's very validating for me to have this book doing so, so well and being well-received, not just selling a lot, but people are really enjoying the book.
And I was finding that, and you have a number of these projects going, where you collect people's voices and compile them into one book. What's that experience like, first of all, as the editor, when you are trying to pull a book together?
It's an administrative nightmare, frankly. But it's also, you know, when you have really good writers, that administrative nightmare is balanced by reading and working with really great writing and writers who are grown-ups and who you can say, you know what, can we flip this? Can we put what you've got here at the end? Can we put it at the top? And you have to really like what you're doing because it is a lot of work, and it's a lot of stories to have going through your head. Mm-hmm. That's another thing, because it was especially challenging for me this year because, as you know, I am the editorial director of TMI Project, a nonprofit that does storytelling memoir. And, you know, I take in so many stories a year in workshops, people telling me their stories, and I help turn them into either essays or monologues. And then on top of that, I edited two anthologies, one with 21 writers and one with 28 writers. Mm-hmm. So I counted, and I had something like 149 stories going through my head this year.
And how did this latest project, Goodbye to All That, compare to Get Out of My Crotch or the other TMI project work that you're doing?
It was very different because the TMI Project stuff and Get Out of My Crotch are both more in the activism vein. Both projects, Get Out of My Crotch and a new show that we're putting together through TMI Project called What to Expect When You're Not Expecting, True Stories of Slips, Surprises, and Happy Accidents, those both benefit Planned Parenthood. They both deal with choice, reproductive choice, and also reproductive rights. And their stories, and I always feel like the best way to convey important messages is through story. Same thing with self-help. Like I gain more knowledge reading someone's story and how they dealt with something than somebody saying, do this, this, and this. So there's a lot of activism involved in those other projects. We have an Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign right now where we're trying to raise money to take it to Texas. That's at notexpecting.org. It just feels really important to get those stories out into the world, to put faces to the illegal abortions pre-Roe v. Wade, to dispel the shame around having had a child and put it up for adoption and then finding it years later. So there's a different objective. With Goodbye to All That, it's more of an artistic, creative undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
But those, it's also such a great essay, the Joan Didion essay, and so many writers aspire to it, and so many people have the experience of leaving New York City and feeling ambivalent about it.
Right.
New York is a living organism, and just like any other place, and more than any other place, it changes constantly. And everybody has their own New York that they remember. I often say that, you know, trying to go back to New York and find it the exact way you left it is like trying to go back into a great dream after you've woken up. You know, well, let me go back into that dream. It's always going to be different from day to day, from minute to minute. But I also feel in the last 10, 15 years, it's taken a jump. There's been this very rapid gentrification that I think has left a lot of people in its wake. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have had to leave. So a lot of people have a lot of strong feelings about New York. I mean, they always do, but I think it's different now.
So what about simply this popularity of the anthology these days? What is going on that there are so many projects out there, and you've got so many of them, where you are collecting other people's voices and then pulling them all together on a common theme?
Yeah, you know, I had contributed to a few in the past, but it does seem like there's an uptick in anthologies. I would say it probably started in the mid-90s, mid or late 90s. There's something about telling the truth, revealing the ugly, quote-unquote ugly truth, revealing our humanity that is very appealing to people. There's a big storytelling movement afoot. You've got The Moth. I think that there's a desire to hear a lot of stories, and a lot of people are having the desire to tell their stories, and it creates connectedness at a time when we're all tweeting and Facebooking and emailing and texting. I think that people like these little installments. You'll listen to a 10-minute Moth episode as you go from point A to point B in your car, and then you'll go do something else. Or you'll read two pieces in an anthology, and then you'll go to sleep, and then the next day you'll do something else. And I think that there's this, I don't think it's necessarily bad. I think it's nice to hear a variety of voices
mm-hmm.
Around a theme. I think it's really interesting to consider something from so many different angles and to know that there are lots of different experiences and that you might actually identify with more than one. Just kind of helps you understand your own life.
Sari Botten is the editor of Goodbye to All That, Writers on Loving and Leaving New York. It is published by Seal Press. Find out more about the TMI Project and what to expect when you're not expecting at tmiproject.org. And finally, a couple of New York memories. When I was a kid, my grandmother used to take me to Horn and Hardart in New York City. If you never went to an automat, it was like the food of the future in the early 60s. Everywhere you looked was tile, formica, and clear plastic. Picture a big, clean cafeteria crossed with a vending machine. 89-year-old Hilda Baumol of Battery Park City in Manhattan remembers the automat and a memorable and long-gone New York City restaurant chain, Childs. It's part of a collection of audio essays called Forgotten Foods of New York.
My name is Hilda Baumol. I live in the Battery Park City part of Manhattan. My family moved every year because the landlord would offer a couple of months concession on the rent if you moved in. So we started off in the East Bronx, and I think mostly went westward. We did not go to elegant restaurants, ever. It was the tail end of the Depression, and you didn't waste your money. Oh, of course there were many restaurants in the city, and many cheap things like coffee shops, and the automat, of course. And you put in your 10 cents, your quarter, and the little door opened, The food was in display, on display inside the boxes, and you took your food. And that was then these mysterious hands would come from behind and refill it. It was very good food. They made baked beans unlike anything you have ever tasted since. They were famous for it. With us, if you really wanted to be fancy, you went to the Child's. You never heard of Child's? Child's was a real restaurant with waitresses and tables, and their specialty was simply the most delicious chocolate syrup you have ever, and I know that's true. They don't make it like that anymore. Oh, you had anything you wanted, well, from the menu. But yes, but what they were famous for was their chocolate syrup, and they put it on ice cream, hot. It was very, very good.
And we finished the show with 68-year-old Christina Lam of Chinatown in Manhattan. She grew up in Hong Kong and moved to New York to work in a garment factory on East Broadway. She remembers how hard it was to adjust to American food.
My name's Christina Lam, and I'm living at Confucius Plaza. I remember when I went to work at East Broadway, the factory, the garment factory. And you can count how many people on the street, less than 10, because everybody working inside the factory, nobody on the street. Canal Street, only half of it open. The other, the lower part of Canal Street, deserted place. When I came here, my mother-in-law was still alive. I stayed with my mother-in-law, and I watched her how to cook. So I learned from her. I have to cook at least one veggies, one soup, one meat, and a soup. So four dishes every day. I cook almost every time the same way, with black beans, garlic, ginger, and tomatoes. Almost all the vegetables we could not find here. We can only find cabbage, tomato, carrots, something like that. We have and many Chinese vegetables like bok choy, Chinese spinach, we could not find here. A different way of eating. Here, most people eat meat the most. They eat a little bit of rice, afraid they will get fat. But in Hong Kong, most people eat two or three bowls of rice and a little bit of meat, veggies. I was scared because people eat a lot of meat. In Hong Kong, our chicken is much tinier, and we cut up to small pieces. But here, they cut big pieces. So when I see it, I don't want to eat it. I told my mother-in-law to put it away. I'm afraid.
These Forgotten Foods of New York interviews were compiled by producer Ann Noy Saney. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.